You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 7th. I'm Abigail Richard from Drake University. Here is our first story. The headline of this story is 50 Years of Beauty. Business marks 50 years of improving area lawns, gardens, by Tim Rower. Subheadline, Cher Bondi's Garden Center. While it started as an old gas station in 1974, the idea of owning a garden center was planted much earlier. Today, 50 years later, Cher Bondi's Garden Center has grown into one of the region's most popular and most successful home garden show places. To celebrate this special milestone, the public is invited to an open house Saturday, beginning with an anniversary ribbon cutting at 9 a.m., followed by many fun and educational activities at 319th 16th Avenue in Council Bluffs. John Cher Bondi, owner and founder, recalled learning important business skills as a young newspaper carrier. "I got a daily nonpareil route that was 2.5 miles long with 110 customers," he said. "That taught me a lot about customer service." At age 14, Cher Bondi got a job at the local Meyer Greenhouse. In a chapter of a book that John and his wife, Catherine Kipp, wrote about their life together, John Cher Bondi was noted for remembering which plant was which and where it was in the greenhouse range. For the next 5 years, he would learn plant skills from second-generation German plant gurus Bill and Floy Meyer, according to their book, Navigating the Plum Thicket. Later, as a student at Iowa State University, John Cher Bondi got a job with the Earl May Seed and Nursery Company. 2 years of garden center retailing augmented his horticulture degree. Eventually, the Cher Bondis decided to go out on their own. "We started 3 blocks away to the north at 1202 South 3rd Street," Kip Cher Bondi said. "It was an old gas station." Financially, they received a $7,000 loan from the Small Business Administration to get going. Her husband said the first day in the business brought in $300. "We thought that was a lot," Kip Cher Bondi said. Eventually, their business outgrew that location, causing them to find a new home, where they've been for many years. "We started with just half of the original building, sharing it with 2 other businesses, Cher Bondi said. Today, the company owns a good amount of property along 16th Avenue, including a large, wide-open space to the south where plants are grown. "This is our retail facility," John Cher Bondi said. "We also have 8 greenhouses and a large field for trees in Underwood. That is our production facility. We grow all of our own." Along with selling traditional garden items over all these years, Cher Bondi's has also taken the lead in offering new products that have become popular today, including a grass seed consisting mostly of turf fescue, but with 10% bluegrass. "It's a sturdier kind of grass," John Cher Bondi said. "We started planting that 50 years ago. Now everybody does it." Cher Bondi's also sells exotic hot peppers, along with a hybrid tomato named in honor of the Council Bluffs resident, Orsis Murphy. Trees popular with the public include the fast-growing autumn blaze maple, with eye-catching fall colors and abundant shade. Cher Bondi's also serves the community by maintaining public green areas, such as the median along the Canesville Boulevard, and the grassy area along the Avenue G Viaduct, to name a couple. "For a period of time, we hired federal prisoners on probation," John Cher Bondi said. "We've had so many success stories from guys who came out of jails and prisons." The Cher Bondis even received a certificate of service to the community from local officials for helping people get back on their feet. John also wrote gardening articles in a local shopper's guide titled Kippy's Corner. "I wrote it as my wife," John Cher Bondi admitted. He offered high praise for his employees. "We have a wonderful staff who are really good people and who work hard at customer service," he said. "There will be many things to do at Saturday's open house, including hot dogs, chips, cookies, cupcakes, and refreshments, a children's coloring contest, potted plant activity for children, a clown will offer balloons for all ages, and a fertilizer expert will be on hand answering questions. Every customer will receive a golden anniversary marigold to take home, and door prizes will be offered as well. There is an image attached to this article. The caption for the image says, from left, Kip Sherbondi, Mason Strong, Bennett Schwaller, Alyssum Sherbondi, Kim Young, and Gianna Sherbondi pose for a portrait outside Sherbondi's Garden Center on Wednesday, March 6, 2024. The Garden Center is celebrating its 50th anniversary of business this year. The image is indeed of six individuals outside of a garden center. You can see the greenhouse walls behind them and a fence in front. The next article is titled, Library Installs New Book Return Machine by Tim Rower. Arnie always went by the book, literally. The Council Bluffs Public Library recently installed a new system that makes book returning through its drive-thru faster and more efficient. The old machine, Arnie, was celebrated with a retirement party. Its replacement is more of a speed reader. It's up and running, Library Director Antonia Krupicka-Smith told the Nonpareil. People are using it. The new machine doesn't have a name yet, but it's sort of filled in for the old machine affectionately named Arnie Schwarzenegger, Arnie for short. People with multiple items could only put in one at a time into Arnie's return drop box, Krupicka-Smith said. They would then have to wait a moment before doing it again, and then again, and so on. Now you can put in a whole stack of books at once and drive away, she said. You don't need to worry about them not being checked in. The new machine has what's called timed belt movements. The new machine has what's called timed belt movements that separate the stack of items before each is scanned and sent into a particular bin. Staff then inspect the items and place them on the shelves. The drop-through drop box is available 24/7 and can accommodate any number of returns from patrons. It saves time for the community, Krupicka-Smith said. It makes it easier for people to get on with their day. The total cost was $150,000, with $50,000 of that coming from the city's capital improvement dollars and the remaining coming from the Council Bluffs Public Library Foundation. Krupicka-Smith said that Arnie was installed in 2012 with state-of-the-art technology for that time. Technology has improved since then, she said. We couldn't upgrade it anymore. In appreciation of Arnie's work over the years, the staff held a retirement party and gave thanks for its service. The library will be seeking the community help in naming this new machine with more details in the coming weeks, Krupicka-Smith said. There is also an image attached to this article. It is of a book on a machine with a bunch of rods, presumably rolling. There is a lady standing behind them and the edges of a bookshelf are seen. The caption underneath this image says, Council Bluffs Public Library Director Antonia Krupicka-Smith watches as the library's new book return system sorts incoming books and other media on Friday, March 1st, 2023. The photo was taken by Joe Shearer for the Nonpareil. The next article is titled Gorman Launches Iowa Senate Campaign by Scott Stewart. Council Bluffs City Council member Steve Gorman announced a campaign Tuesday for Iowa Senate District 10. Gorman, a Democrat, is running for the seat currently held by Senator Dan Donson, a Republican who is seeking re-election this fall to represent most of Council Bluffs and Carter Lake. The people of Council Bluffs have seen a lack of opportunity because Dan Donson and the Iowa Senate Republicans have failed to fulfill their promises, Gorman said in a news release. Gorman has served on the council since 2021 and is a 30-year member of the Council Bluffs Fire Department. He is a former journeyman electrician. I'm running for Iowa Senate to bring common sense Council Bluffs values back to Des Moines, Gorman said. I will bring opportunity back to Council Bluffs by advocating for a stronger public education system, ensuring everyone has an opportunity to earn a livable wage, and protecting Iowans' freedoms to health care from government overreach. Gorman lives in the historic Gibraltar neighborhood of Council Bluffs. Council Bluffs is where I spent 30 years serving my neighbors as a firefighter, and my wife, Chris, an educator in its public school system, Gorman said. We have dedicated our lives to serving the city's most vulnerable. I will continue that service in the State Senate to ensure every Iowan can make their own choices and live their own lives without undue interference or restrictions in lieu of what we have been given by Republicans in Des Moines. Dawson is serving his second term in the Iowa Senate, where he is the chair of the influential Ways and Means Committee, which considers legislation related to tax policy and budgeting. He also serves in the Iowa Army National Guard and as a special agent investigating major crimes for the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Dawson touted historic income tax relief for Iowa's families and legislation to improve Lake Manawa among his accomplishments in launching his re-election bid last November. Find more information on Gorman's campaign at gormanforsenate.com. There is an image attached to this article. It is of a man standing in front of the firefighter of Council Bluffs logo, I presume. The caption underneath the image reads, Council Bluffs City Councilman Steve Gorman, a longtime firefighter, speaks to family, friends, and colleagues during his retirement ceremony, October 1st, 2021. The next story is called TJ Students Use Art to Promote Colorectal Cancer Awareness at All Care by Joe Shearer. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and All Care Health Center in Council Bluffs is artistically acknowledging the cause thanks to the handiwork of some Thomas Jefferson High School students. Last Friday, Thomas Jefferson art teacher Lori Bancroft brought a van of her six. Last Friday, Thomas Jefferson art teacher Lori Bancroft brought a van full of her ceramic students down to the All Care facility, 902 South 6th Street, where they spent the day painting its windows with blue ribbon, funds the designs, and messages of hope for those dealing with issues related to colon cancer. The students included Stephanie Porter, Carly Morris, Valeria Esquivel, Jennifer Silva, Jordan Manzer, Miles Auten, Jasmine Hadeen, and Danielle Stang. The students spent all morning and afternoon working on the project, and many All Care employees came outside throughout the day to see their work. Some even got in on the fun. Courtney Burke, a medical coder at All Care, got her hand painted blue by Bancroft so she could add a handprint to one of the window's designs. Stacy Woolley, care coordinator at All Care, said it was great having the students there. She said she appreciated not only having the facility brighter and more colorful, but also having the students' work promote awareness for a cause that she says more and more Americans are having to be familiar with. It's very important to get screened, starting at the age of 45, she said. They are finding more and more young people with colon cancer, so the quicker you can get screened, if it's caught early, it's 100% treatable. According to statistics provided by the Iowa Primary Care Association, colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in the U.S. An estimated 1,660 Iowans will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer this year, and 1 in 23 men and 1 in 26 women will be diagnosed with it in their lifetime. Those numbers are why Woolley said spreading awareness is needed now more than ever. She said she hopes the Thomas Jefferson students' art will help be the spark that gets more people and their families informed and ready for getting screened. Along with the art at All Care, Woolley said the medical center is holding contests for patients, staff, and providers throughout the month. She also said the fountain at Bayless Park will be lit blue to recognize Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. There are multiple photos attached to this article. The first one is a wide shot of two students painting blue, light blue, and white cancer ribbons on multiple windows. It is captioned, Thomas Jefferson High School's art students Jordan Manzer, Wright, and Danielle Stang paint All Care Health Center's windows in observance of Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month on Friday. The image below is a close-up of the back of the head. beck of the head of someone else painting a light blue cancer ribbon on a window, a wide shot of six of the windows, and a group photo. The group photo has the caption, "All healthcare center employees pose for a portrait with Thomas Jefferson High School art students outside the clinic after the students decorated the building's windows in observance of Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month on Friday." There is then another photo of a woman with her hand painted blue, seemingly just having added a blue handprint to one of the windows. There is an image of a hand being painted blue, an image of the building at large, and an image of two students climbing onto the windows to paint higher up on the windows. I am now switching to the opinion section. This article is headlined, "It's Time for Vilsack to Stop Appealing Big Ag," by Art Colon. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack complained last week of getting batted about left and right from one day to the next. It can be lonely at the top, so you rope-a-dope your way along trying to stay afoot. He referred to a protester Tuesday at the Ag Outlook Forum who thinks USDA is a corporate sellout, and to banging his head against the wall knuckleheads on the House Agriculture Committee who can't muster a farm bill on time. The Ag Census reports that Iowa farm sizes grew along with net income through 2022. Dairy and livestock sectors continued to consolidate. Just a few players dominate the industry. Young farmers can't find a foothold. Soil losses are frightening. Pork exports are expected to eclipse poultry in 10 years as Asian demand grows exponentially. We can't handle the manure we already have. Just take a sniff outside and don't dare dip in the river. Vilsack's lament comes somewhat from his own making. The former Iowa governor believes that climate-smart agriculture built around resiliency and sustainability will lead to diversity in production. He also understands that money greases political wheels. When Biden took office, Vilsack lined up all the big players in agribusiness for his climate-smart initiative. Cargill, Tyson, ADM, everybody who's anybody. They issued joint statements with the support of the House and Senate Agriculture Committee leaders. It hasn't worked. The House halted the farm bill over food stamps. Funding is frozen. At the committee hearing last week, Vilsack was under fire for fear that climate action will heist property rights. The message from the corporatists to the Capitol to get smart on climate got a wink and no reply. Nor has the USDA climate smart money directed by Vilsack so far, some $20 billion, made an appreciable difference in Iowa surface water or air quality. Young farmers are not getting a boot on the ladder to success. The integrators get theirs, while folks in Storm Lake get ballooning water bills as our wells are sucked dry. Vilsack thought he could bring the Republicans along. They would rather fight than eat. They can't decide on the border, on Ukraine, not even on a farm bill that the Farmers Union and Cargill could settle for. Perhaps a pivot is in order. The farm bill architecture got us into this fix. Give the Freedom Caucus what it wants, rip it up, and see where the pieces land. Tell Big Ag to stuff it. Say to hell with subsidizing huge corporations with money that is supposed to get grass strips planted along the Raccoon River. Quit indirectly subsidizing pork exports to China at the expense of Iowa's soil base. Tell them they don't need our money to build a CO2 pipeline. Use executive authority to enroll every eligible applicant into the Conservation Stewardship Program and the Conservation Reserve Program, both popular and suppressed. Tie crop insurance to stewardship. The Ag Census chronicles of the failure of the existing farm bill architecture. The House hearing last week illustrates the failure of the Vilsack corporate-based political strategy to prop up its sagging frame. With Speaker Mike Johnson at the rostrum, how can we see a way clear to a farm bill before the November election? It is nigh on impossible. Wouldn't it be novel if Vilsack went full bore for Iowa? For clean water and air, for independent livestock production, for open and transparent markets, for healthy and diverse rural communities where you can make a decent living. Iowa does not have that now. Not, at least, from a Sac or Pocahontas country perspective. The reason to send all those Iowa boys to Washington is so they can deliver some of that bacon home to where it is fattened and sliced. What about Storm Lake's failing wells brought on by agri-industrial demand? Who pays for that? What about our lost soil? Where is the accounting? The big boys may be flush, but what about the rest of us? Why should our cheap corn be used to undermine the very foundation of Iowa, its soil, water, and people? Joe Biden could win Iowa with a campaign like that. Vilsack once did. Production agriculture is hanging on to its friend Vilsack, is hanging its friend Vilsack out to dry politically. Agribusiness claims to support resiliency and security, but it funds the ag committee that fails to produce a farm bill. It lets the knuckleheads box Vilsack around. He will never miss a meal if he tells all of them to sit and spin on this in defense of Iowa's values. That's what we need. Vilsack is capable of it if he could summon the courage of his stated vision. Art Colin is editor of Storm Lake Times Pilot, where this column first appeared, as well as Art Colin's notebook on Substack. It is republished via the Iowa Capital Dispatch as part of the Iowa Writers Collaborative. Here we have another opinion column. Jonah Goldberg. This is what's wrong with the rush to accuse Israel of committing genocide in Gaza. If I were a Palestinian struggling amid the rubble in Gaza, I would probably think Israel is committing genocide. If I were a German hiding in Dresden or a Japanese civilian outside Hiroshima in 1945, I'd probably feel the same way about the United States. But none of these amount to genocide. Genocide has a specific definition. The deliberate and systematic extermination of a national, racial, political, or cultural group. The term was coined by Raphael Lemkin, a Polish Jew, in response to Winston Churchill's observations about the Holocaust. We are in the presence of a crime without a name. In fairness, images of war, particularly of this war, can seem to indicate genocide. But in Gaza, this stems in no small part from Hamas's strategy. They cannot win and will not fight a conventional war. Palestinian civilians don't get bomb shelters. Only Hamas fighters do. The point remains. If supposedly all-powerful Israel has been bent on genocide, it's oddly bad at it. According to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics, the Palestinian population has grown more than eightfold since Israel's founding, while the population of the Gaza Strip has increased 600% since 1960. So maybe genocide was never Israel's intent in the first place. Of course, you can't say the same about Hamas and Hezbollah. They're open about their goal of eliminating Israel. Even denunciations of Israel often undermine the genocide claim. Israel is condemned for inadequate warnings about attacks and insufficient humanitarian support to Gaza. But if genocide were the aim, why drop warning leaflets or provide aid at all? Alas, it's a sign of the times that absolving Israel of Hitlerite genocide counts as an outrageous defense of Israel. It's a bit like when I tell some of my fellow Trump critics that Donald Trump isn't Hitler, and they react like I'm rushing to his defense. There's plenty to criticize Israel about without resorting to genocide accusations, and plenty of very negative labels can defensibly, or at least arguably, be used to criticize Israel's actions in Gaza. Inhumane, excessive, wanton, without mischaracterizing its intent. The claim that Israeli policy towards Palestinians is racist and genocidal is very old, with deep roots in Soviet propaganda along with Holocaust denial. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader in the West Bank, wrote his doctoral dissertation on this garbage at Moscow's Patrice Lumumba University. Vladimir Putin, whose war against Ukraine does fit the UN's definition of genocide, has revived this tactic to distract and divide the West. All of this is worth noting, and not just to demonstrate the pretextual nature of the accusation and highlight the recent double standard applied to Israel at the UN and elsewhere. In recent years, American journalists have anguished over the problems of disinformation in general, and Russian disinformation in particular. there was a related, robust debate over whether journalists should call Trump's lies lies. Politicians, pundits, and activists routinely accused Israel of genocide, even massive genocide, with little to no pushback from the press. In fact, the opposite is more common. The press often leaps at allegations, often initially made by Hamas, that seem to confirm the genocide charge, only to have to backtrack later when the facts emerge. Loose assertions of genocide have consequences, none good. First, genocide is, understandably, one of those concepts that psychologically arouses a sense of total moral authority in its opponents. Any form of resistance can be justified, which is why so many people have bent over backwards to justify or contextualize the horror of Hamas's October 7th attack. It can even lead disturbed young men to set themselves ablaze to protest it, and for alleged lovers of peace to celebrate it. Second, this mindset fosters collective guilt. Jews around the world, regardless of their attitudes towards Israel or Zionism, are being targeted for abuse and discrimination simply for their alleged complicity in genocide. Many extremists subscribe to moral tautology that says Israel is like Nazi Germany, and therefore if you support Israel, you're akin to a Nazi. And since Jews support Israel, Jews or Zionists are fair game for all manner of harassment and exclusion. Finally, if Israel is going to be accused of genocide regardless of its actions, it has that much less incentive to show restraint in its efforts to defeat an enemy that is actually genocidal. Indeed, those most loudly calling for a ceasefire to stop Israeli genocide often fall short of demanding that Hamas surrender. That would stop the genocide, bloodshed by any name, tomorrow, but apparently that's a bridge too far for those outraged by genocide. Goldberg is an editor-in-chief of The Dispatch at thedispatch.com. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 7th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Abigail Richard from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. There is an obituary today for Barbara Jean Fisher. She lived from May 22, 1941 to March 5, 2024. Barbara Jean Fisher, age 82, passed away March 5, 2024, at Jenny Edmondson Hospital. Barbara was born May 22, 1941 in Council Bluffs to the late James and Mary Whitman Orme and graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1959. At TJ, Barbara was active in choir and cheerleading. She was united in marriage to Louis C. Fisher on April 1, 1960. Barbara worked many years in the insurance industry, starting at Mutual of Omaha, Grain Dealer Mutual, and ending her career at Paula Sass Insurance. Her hobbies included traveling, flowers, and most of all, spending time with her family. In addition to her parents, she is preceded in death by her husband, Lou, on May 14, 2007. Barbara is survived by daughters, Jody Halligan, and husband, Corey, of Council Bluffs, Julie Bowles and husband, Tony, of Glenwood, Iowa, grandchildren, Eric Halligan and wife, Valerie, Haley Putnam and husband, Dustin, all of Council Bluffs, great-granddaughters, Carly and Kylie Halligan, great-grandson, Walker Putnam, special dog and friend, Sarge. Visitation, Friday, 1 to 2 p.m., followed by funeral service at 2 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Barbara will be laid to rest with husband Lou at the Crescent Cemetery, followed by luncheon at the Crescent Fire Barn. Family will direct memorials. The next article is from the sports section. Final four roll cards. Trainor wins fifth straight state set quarterfinal to advance to semifinals. By Peter Burnett, 2A State Basketball. Des Moines, Final Four roll call? More like roll cards. Fifth-seeded Traynor won their fifth straight state quarterfinal by answering a West Burlington push with a dominant fourth quarter in a 73-63 win Monday night. The last five times we went to state, we've been here in the Final Four. I'm an old coach, said 18-year but still youthful Cardinals head coach Scott Rucker. I love having a week to prepare, but that's what I love about coaching. Rucker also loved the effort his team showed in the win and how the players and his staff executed the game plan. We just felt good about our plan coming in, he said. What else are we going to do for a week? But it gets harder now. We've got three days, and we'll stay up tonight. But we tell our kids there's nothing like a state tournament except for winning games at the state tournament. So they get to experience that. I'm really happy. The Cardinals had about a lovely start as they could have asked for, as Alec Lovely drilled a three-pointer to start the scoring. The Cardinals would start on an 8-0 run and expand their lead to 13-4 as they started 7-9 from the field and 3-4 on three-pointers. It's always good to get off to a good start, Rucker said. I think it's probably especially good in the state tournament for the first time for sure. The Falcons chipped away at the deficit, getting it as close to two by getting to the line and taking advantage. In the bonus with 4 minutes 39 seconds left in the first, the Falcons finished 7-8 on free throws while the Cardinals were 1-6. But shooting 4-9 on three-pointers helped the Cardinals hold a 5-point lead after the first. After being held in check in the opening 8 minutes, senior Jace Tam started heating up, making three straight field goals as the Cardinals went on a 7-2 spurt to increase their lead back to 8. The Falcons weren't done yet, however, twice cutting the deficit just 1 point as leading scorer Mason Watkins tallied 13 first-half points. Tam and Lovely combined for 21 points, shooting 9-14 from the field, 3-7, as the Cardinals carried a 32-28 lead into the locker room. Traynor started the second half on the front foot, but momentum quickly turned to West Burlington. The Falcons made three straight shots to take their first lead of the game, 40-39, on a Kobe Davis pull-up jumper with 4 minutes and 16 left in the third. The teams would go back and forth after a first half without one, five lead changes sent the pendulum swinging. West Burlington would ultimately grab the edge in the quarter, getting their lead to as many as five before Corbin Thien scored five to make the deficit 53-50 heading into the fourth. Early in the fourth, Carson Elwood took control, making a close basket and converting and one to tie at the game at 55. I'm able to use my size in a game like that. We're not used to it, but when we're not as tall, but a lot of those plays are really set up by my teammates, Elwood said. Like when I was able to get that and one. It's perfect. When we have shooters like that on the outside, they're going to attract attention. So it's going to give me one-on-one opportunities, and I just got to finish. All even with 6 minutes to play, Watkins was fouled on a three-point attempt, but made two of three to put the Falcons up two. Alec Lovely then drilled a three-pointer from the wing created by an Elwood offensive rebound to put the Cardinals up 58-57 with 4 minutes 28 seconds left. That's been our thing throughout the year. We've had some close games, and we just figured that if we keep our cool, we can easily win the game, Lovely said. That was just our mindset. Keep our cool and see what happens. Lovely would finish with a co-game high 22 points, tied with West Burlington's Mason Watkins, to go with 4 rebounds and 2 assists. The Cardinals would make a 5-point lead after a pair of three throws from Lovely and a layup by Ethan Kahns. Lovely and Rucker thought rebounding and help side defense were the keys in the fourth quarter resurgence. I feel like in the third quarter, we didn't have a lot of help side, but in the fourth quarter, they couldn't really do a whole lot, Lovely said. couldn't really do a whole lot, roughly translates to 2:14 from the field as the Falcons went the first 6 minutes and 50 seconds of the fourth quarter without a made field goal. That lead would stretch to 7-9 before a pair of Corbin free throws made it 11 for the Cardinals' largest lead of the game. Dan would finish the game 8-9 from the line, scoring 12 points and pulling down 5 rebounds. I just rolled to the basket and I just got the easy dump downs, and they just fouled me a lot, Thien said. The refs were calling a lot, but we had to be mentally tough, and we knew that we were going to get fouled out. Edwood found his place on the bench with 2 minutes 46 seconds left. We had to be encouraging on the bench, Thien continued, and keep the mentality going throughout the bench the entire game. The Falcons made their first made field goal of the final quarter on a 3 with 1 minute 10 seconds left, but it was home and dry for the Cardinals. 5 Cardinals, Lovely, Tams, Thien, Elwood, Cons, finished in double figures. In spite of scoring just 3 points in the first quarter, Tams turned things around and had the support of his teammates around him. At the end of the day, that's what's special about this team, Tams said. They can try and take me away, and then Alec, Carson, Ethan, Aaron, MK, Corbin, everyone else is going to do their thing. For Rucker, it's the first time he can remember this season that he's had 5 players with at least 10 points each. I think we have 5 guys that are definitely capable. They haven't done it all in the same night. I'm quite positive we haven't, but I think that each guy kind of played their role really well, Rucker said. By attacking the glass and pressuring the rim, the Cardinals answered the Falcons' flight and earned a hard-fought win. Tams was an example of that, overcoming what Rucker said the senior guard might call on off night 6-16 on field goals by pulling down 9 rebounds for a near double-double. He wasn't quite scoring like he normally does or shooting like he normally does, but he found ways to impact the game, Rucker said. Now, Trainer goes back to the 2A semifinals for the 5th straight time, where they'll match up with number 1 Western Christian, hole 213, at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday. The calling card? You guessed it, toughness. You know what I'm going to say, it's going to take some toughness, and that toughness will manifest itself in how we rebound the basketball, Reckner said. Trainer, 22-13, 19-13, 18-23, 73, West Burlington, 22-1, 14-14, 25, 10-63. There is an image attached to this article. The caption beneath the image reads, "The Cardinal bench celebrates a 3 in the first quarter of the 2A state quarterfinal game against West Burlington at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines on Monday." It is of roughly 5 boys in bright red uniforms jumping up with their coach squatting down next to them. They are visibly excited. The next article is titled, "Easter Baskets Full of Toys Donated to Children's Square." Children's Square recently received gifts and toys for Easter baskets from Retail Rebel in Council Bluffs. "We are thankful for the baskets and goodies donated by Retail Rebel," Viv Ewing, president and CEO of Children's Square, said in a news release. "They will bring great joy to our children on campus this Easter season." Children's Square is a 141-year-old nonprofit organization that operates 24/7 to serve children with mental health needs. Children in residential treatment and in the organization's emergency shelter are often on campus during holidays that would otherwise be spent with family. "Our staff works hard to make holidays a special time for children who cannot be with their families on Easter, Christmas, and other holidays," Jonathan Holland, Chief Program Officer at Children's Square, said in a release. Ewing said the group is appreciative of the community's long-standing support. She said that a significant portion of our budget is realized by the generosity of individuals who understand the need to provide mental health services for our youth and support for their families. Children's Square is grateful for in-kind, monetary, and planned giving donations that allow the organization to remain a fixture for children and families in our area who need mental health and behavioral health services. There is an image attached to this article of three people posing in front of a Children's Square USA backdrop, two of them holding Easter baskets. The caption under the image reads, "Retail Rebel donated Easter baskets recently to Children's Square." Pictured from left are Children's Square Emergency Shelter Supervisor Jeremy Decker, Shelley Woods of Retail Rebel, and Gail Dwyer, Children's Square Marketing and Events Manager. Our next article is titled Seed Stash. Now's a good time to check out your leftover seeds. This comes to you from Melinda Myers from the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. Gardening. As you scour the seed catalogs and websites for new and favorite flower and vegetable seeds, take time to inventory the seeds you have saved from previous years. You'll save money by not buying more of the seeds you already have, so you'll have more to spend on something new. Starting with fresh seeds from a reliable seed company helps boost your growing success. But what gardener can resist getting the most out of every purchase by saving and planting seeds left from previous years? Check the dates. Seeds stored in a consistently cool, not freezing, dry, dark location can last for 1 to 5 or more years. Start by checking the packaging or expiration date on the packet. Onions, parsley, parsnips, and salsify seeds usually last 1 year, while corn, okra, and pepper seeds last an average of 2 years. Beans and peas generally last for 3 years. Tomatoes, turnips, beets, chard, and watermelon last 4, and Brussels sprouts, cabbage, muskmelon, radishes, and spinach are the longest lasting at 5 years. Perennial flower seeds last an average of 2 to 4 years, while annual flower seeds last from 1 to 3 years, depending on the species. There are always exceptions, with a few seeds that were found lasting more than 100 years. You may find your properly stored seeds last longer than the averages, but once seeds pass their average life expectancy, you may see a reduction in germination. Test viability. Use this quick and easy test to see if your stored seeds will sprout and grow. Place 10 seeds on a damp paper towel. Roll up the towel with the seeds safely tucked inside. Set the paper towel in a plastic bag and store it in a warm, dark location. After a week or so, unwrap the paper towel and check the seeds for sprouting. If nothing has happened, rewrap the seeds and wait a few more days. If all of the seeds have sprouted, you have 100% germination and can plant the seeds according to the label directions. If only half the seeds sprout, you should plant the seeds twice as thick to compensate for the lower germination. You can plant these sprouted seeds if you have the available gardening space and the growing conditions are right for the seeds to grow. If none of the seeds sprout, consider breaking out the glue and getting the family involved in turning these non-viable seeds into seed art. Then make some adjustments to your seed storage strategies in the future. Leave seeds in their original packaging so you have all the information you need when inventorying and planting the seeds in the following season. Place the envelope in an airtight container and store it in the refrigerator or consistently cool, not freezing location. If you've lost seeds to hungry rodents, try storing them in the refrigerator or metal or glass containers. Sealed plastic containers are fine for the seeds, but hungry mice can eat their way through the plastic to your stored seeds. Share or swap. Many gardeners often end up with more seeds than they will ever grow. Considering sharing these with others by donating them to school groups, community gardeners, and master gardeners who will put them to use in various gardens in your community. Or organize a seed swap party. Gather your gardening friends or work colleagues and have participants bring their seeds and catalogs. Seed swaps are a great way to find unusual or unique seeds. They're also a great way to save money and get the greatest value by sharing extra seeds with friends and family. Once the seed swapping is done, you might consider making a group seed order. Working together, you'll be able to order a wider variety of seeds for greater diversity in the garden. Everyone can take what they need so that there will be fewer seeds to save in the future. Plus, ordering larger packets is usually more economical. And you'll have an excuse for another party when you meet up to divide the goods. Melinda Myers has written more than 20 gardening books, including The Midwest Gardener's Handbook and Small Space Gardening. There is an image attached to this article, and it is simply of a hand with seeds inside of it. Our next article is from the television section, headlined, On the Road Again. Eugene Levy follows the road less traveled with Reluctant Traveler, by Bruce R. Miller of the Sioux City Journal. Television. When producers told him he was touring Europe in the second season of The Reluctant Traveler, Eugene Levy thought he'd be hitting the continent's greatest cities. Instead, the executive producer, David Brindley, "We actually take Eugene very much off the beaten track. That means he's in a wellness facility in Germany, a rain-soaked midsummer festival in Sweden, and a working-class community in Scotland that even his Scottish mother didn't want to revisit. If you were to ask me, in your dream, what country in the world are you just dying to get to? I'd say, I don't know, because there isn't one place I'm dying to get to," Levy says. The thrill of agreeing to a series like this hinges on the adventure that it offers. "It makes me a more enlightened person and possibly a more interesting person," Levy says. "And I love my interaction with the people. They really make those trips memorable for me. The lodging, not so much." In Germany, the Schitt's Creek star says, the Schitt's Creek star stays in a wellness facility where he drinks clear broth and has a piece of very stale bread for dinner. "I actually had to cheat and go over to the hotel where the crew was staying to get the occasional cheeseburger," he says. Because Brindley doesn't elaborate, Levy often learns about the itinerary just before it happens. If I was on my own and somebody said, "Hey, do you want to go to the Philippines or India or something?" I'd probably say, "You know what? Maybe not this year," Levy says. "It wouldn't get me out of the house." But the fact that the show actually gets me out of the house to kind of experience this, there's a lot that I truly enjoy. The Emmy winner also found that he felt sorry for residents in some parts of the world. In Sweden, for example, it was a very thick season for mosquitoes, he says. "You really couldn't enjoy being outside at all because you're swatting a lot of the time. At a midsummer festival there, it poured, and the locals who were dressed in elaborate costumes were drenched. You would never know anything was wrong because they were as enthusiastic as they would have been if there had been no rain and the sun was shining," Levy says. In Scotland, where his mother was born, Levy had a moment that only someone like Henry Louis Gates Jr. could prompt. "The connection I actually felt as soon as I got to the country was very palpable," he says. "While his mother's home is no longer standing, he could sense the kind of life she had. She never talked about how bad it was, how crowded it was. It really put an emotional charge in me, and I'm glad I did it." Like Finding Your Roots, The Reluctant Traveler afforded Brindley an opportunity to tell Levy's biographical story. "He's not somebody who does a huge amount of interviews about his innermost thinking," Brindley says. "To be there at that moment, it feels quite special. I've always had a strong appreciation for family," Levy says. "I don't have to be away to appreciate and understand what's going on here. I just relate to it right away." And the food? German broth aside, The Reluctant Traveler says he found haggis horrible. "It's every part of an animal's body that you would not want in a recipe," Levy says. "The best? I love Italian food, and every single thing at the hotel in Tuscany where we were staying was exceptionally great," he says. I really hated to leave there because you got so excited every day about a meal." Season 2 of The Reluctant Traveler with Eugene Levy streams on Apple TV+. There is an image accompanying this article of three people bent over a fence holding onto a plant. The caption underneath the image reads, "Eugene Levy checks the floor in Sweden in The Reluctant Traveler." The next article is from the sports section. Wings clipped. Underwood falls to Unity Christian in 2A state quarterfinals. By Austin Hine. 2A state basketball. From Des Moines. They flew higher than they have ever before, but ultimately the Eagles had their wings clipped in the 2A state quarterfinals. In their first ever trip to state, number 3 Underwood fought back and forth with number 6 Unity Christian, but ultimately fell short 59-55 Tuesday in Des Moines. The loss hurts, but the reality is only 4 teams, one in each class, end their season with a win, Eagles coach Brad Blum said. "It's still nice to end the season at Wells Fargo Arena. A lot of teams have that goal as well, and we were fortunate enough to be one of the 8 teams to do that." The Knights made the first move, capping the first quarter with a 7-0 run, including a put back in the dying seconds. The Eagles' offense began heating up in the second quarter with three tries in the second, which helped spark a 10-0 run that put Underwood ahead 21-18 midway through the second quarter. The Knights, however, responded with an 8-1 run to pull front, and the Eagles missed some key free throws down the stretch to put the Knights up 25-21 at the break. Underwood finished 11-21 at the free throw line. The Eagles came out with a 7-2 spurt to trim the Knights' lead to just 2-2, just to have the Knights score the next five to push the deficit back up to 7. The Knights would eventually push their lead up to 10 midway through the fourth quarter, looking like they may put the game away. With one more push, Underwood collected some transition baskets, two coming from Josh Ravlin, to spark a 6-0 run to pull back within the four. The Eagles would get back within 2 points with 8.9 seconds left, but it was too late as the Knights sank two free throws to seal the game. "These guys have made a big difference," Blum said. "This team has accomplished a lot of firsts, and you can't do things a second time until you've done it the first time. For that, this group will always have a special place in my heart and in this community for what they've accomplished." Owen Larson and Jack Van Fossen culled the Eagles with double-doubles. Both scored 13 points, while Van Fossen collected 13 rebounds, and Owen Larson collected 10 rebounds. Mason Boothby followed with 12 points, 4 assists, 3 steals, and Ravlin added 11 points. The Eagles will graduate 6 seniors who played a huge part in this historic season's run. Endings like this are never easy, but the seniors still hold their heads high after being the first team to make the trip to state. "It's been a very special year for our group," Boothby said. "We've been a close group since the beginning. We're all great friends and hang out even after practices. It's never felt like a job to go to practice with these guys. I can't speak enough on how great this group has been, and I feel like we've laid a great foundation here. I hope this year creates the new standard for Underwood," Van Fossen said. "This isn't going to be the last time we're here. There's some kids underneath us that are going to work and see what it means to be here, and they're going to grind until they get this program back here. I don't think I've ever had as much fun as I had when playing with these guys," Larson said. "We made history with the first trip to state here, and since we had so many seniors, I know it is hard to get some of the younger guys in big games like this, but they kept showing up at practice, and they'll be ready." Underwood ends their season with a record of 24-1, Unity Christian 24-1, 15-14, 13-17, 59, Underwood 24-1, 8-17, 12-18, 15. There is an image accompanying this article of the Eagles team standing lined up. They are posing in front of the bleachers, and one of them is holding a trophy. The caption underneath the image reads, "The Underwood boys basketball team after the 2A state basketball quarterfinals loss to Unity Christian at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines on Tuesday." And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 7th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Abigail Richard from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.